Hello, everyone. Welcome to Skype a Scientist Live Archaeology Week. This week, we are learning about all different types of archaeology. Yesterday, we learned all about Roman toilets, which was a delight. And if you missed it, don't worry. It's now available on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Skype a Scientist. Today, we're talking all about leprosy. I'm looking at old skeletons to figure out what's going on there. This is something I know literally nothing about, so I'm going to be learning a lot today from our guest, Maria Liston. So at this point, I'm going to hand it over to Maria, and she's going to take it from here.
All right. Well, thank you so much, and thank you for the invitation to talk about my work. I'm here in the library of the Swiss School of Archaeology Excavations in Eretria, Greece, working on a different project, but I appreciate their letting me use their space. I'm going to share my screen now. I'm going to give a talk of about 15 minutes and then we can do questions. That's not it. Oh, let's see.
If at any point you have questions during Maria's presentation, please submit them to the Q&A and then we'll ask them after the presentation.
Okay, are you getting my screen now?
Yes, it looks like we're looking at the edit. Yes, now it looks full screen, looks perfect.
Okay, very good. All right, so I am a biological anthropologist and I work as an archaeologist on various excavations. And one project I've been working on is in Thebes, Greece. Thebes is the site of much of, or many myths that you may have heard of. Ever read Oedipus Rex, the ancient Greek play, that's where Thebes, or it took place in Thebes. The modern town of Thebes sits on top of the ancient town here, but just outside of it, here on this tree-covered hill, there's been an excavation of a temple of Apollo, and you can see just a little bit of the foundations there. But what they found was, after it ceased to be an ancient sanctuary, it became a cemetery. So here you see an outline of the temple foundations and then the columns that would have surrounded it. But in blue, you see all of the graves that we found, both in the temple and outside of it as well. And there were 29 graves that had human bone in them. There are others that were dug in the early part of the 20th century, and we don't have any records from those, but this is what the cemetery looks like. It was dated using the ceramics or the pottery. And so a lot of the graves have pots like this in them. And they date to the 6th to the 9th centuries CE or AD. So it's early Christian. The graves are Christian form. They're oriented east-west with the heads in the west. The burials have some variations. Some of the graves have entire bodies in them like this, and they're actually three people stacked up here and this one on the left. Others are a little different. In modern Greece, people moved from the grave after about 5 to 7 years. And this is because there's not a lot of land. And if you create enormous cemeteries like we have in North America, you use up all your land. And so graves are temporary and then the bones are put into an ossuary. And it looks like this was already happening, at least partially, here in the early Christian period. Because what we have is graves that are full of legs. And sometimes the pelvis, but mostly just legs, and the rest of the body's been removed. So that's been a little interesting to work with. In addition, there were two mass graves on the site, two graves that have lots of people put into them all at once. And the graves were bigger. You can see they're sort of big ovals. And everything about them suggested that this was done with a great deal of haste. They were in a hurry to get a lot of people buried quickly. And that suggests some sort of disaster, probably disease. The graves, the two mass graves are located right here, these two yellow ones. So it's part of the cemetery, but again, they're a bit different from the others. What we have in the burials is an array of different diseases, and this includes things like rheumatoid arthritis. This was an older woman who suffered from this, and it had sort of fused her wrists together. It's somewhat unusual to find, but it was an interesting discovery. We also have a lot of cancer at the site, so what we call neoplastic diseases. And this adult male had some sort of metastatic cancer. So it started in another organ and then spread to his bones. And this is a good example of the partial exhumations. All of the gray bones are missing. In this case, they left his pelvis and part of his lower spine, but all the red markers are where we found cancer. And then we were able to compare this to bones from the University of Athens, known pathology cases. So these are modern cancer cases, and these are some of the ancient ones. There's also an unusual tumor in the inner ear that's very rare, and we found an individual with that. And there's a child who has leukemia. So inflammation of the areas of the skeleton where blood cells are produced, and it has, he died at roughly the age of 7 to 8 years because of this. So an unusual amount of different types of diseases. With x-rays, we were able to confirm the leukemia. These bright white lines here on the end of the growth plates are typical of leukemia. There's also an infant who probably had some leukemia as well. But what we found even more of, besides the cancers, was infectious diseases. So diseases caused by pathogens such as bacteria, viruses, of course, a very common topic today that we're dealing with, and can also be caused by parasites. We have a type of disease that individuals were catching from the animals that they were herding and eating called brucellosis that causes lesions like this on the vertebra. The mass graves almost certainly are people who died of infectious disease, and unlike leprosy, which we're going to get to here in a minute, this was something that killed people pretty quickly. Again, the evidence of real haste and rush to get people in the ground suggests a lot of people were dying quickly. The individuals in those mass graves include infants and children and teenagers and adults. So it's across the population, it's hitting everybody. And so that suggests some sort of really bad infectious disease. During this time period, during the period the graves were being used, the Mediterranean was suffering from an epidemic, a pandemic, really, of what was called the Justinianic Plague, because it began under the reign of the Roman Emperor Justinian. We now know from DNA samples that this was bubonic plague, which later, of course, devastated Europe over and over again. This was the first incident of bubonic plague. And so we suspect that's what's going on here, and we have bone and tooth samples that are being tested for pathogen DNA. And so we hope to be able to identify this soon. Other possibilities could be smallpox, typhoid, dysentery, even malaria, an array of different diseases, but not COVID-19, of course, because it's new. But leprosy seems to be the most common disease. Now, leprosy is primarily a skin disease, and it was known in the ancient world. This is a medieval manuscript where you have a priest here speaking to a group of lepers, and the spots on their face tell us that. It's still a problem today. It is a disease that probably originated in India or Africa, although just recently there's been a DNA study suggesting that Europe is a possibility too. So we don't really know where it comes from. It was spread through the ancient world, traditionally has been suggested Alexander the Great's soldiers brought it. But in fact, it seems to be a bit later than that. And it seems to be the Roman army and the slave trade during the Roman period that spread leprosy around the Mediterranean and into Europe. It has an array of different terms. Some of you may be familiar with the biblical laws about leprosy. That probably was not actually what we call leprosy today. But the Greek word lepra, which just means a wound, has come to mean the what we call leprosy today. It is a difficult disease to study. It's caused by a bacterium, but it's one that you can't grow in a laboratory. And so that makes it very difficult to study. It does also occur naturally in two different animals that you would not think are closely related to us at all and aren't. The armadillo in the American Southwest, and recently it's been found in red squirrels in Britain. But otherwise, animals don't catch leprosy, and it's not clear why these two have this disease. It is primarily a skin disease, and here you see a early 20th century photo of a man with leprosy. It causes all sorts of lesions on the face and is a very slow disease. It can take from 4 months to 30 years to begin to show symptoms of it on your skin. Skeletal lesions are fairly rare and can take a very long time to develop. But of course, with archaeological remains, the skeleton is all we see. It is found in most of the graves at the site, including the mass graves. So it seems to be something that's a common feature among the site. In Athens, Greece, there is a hospital that treats skin diseases that has an early 20th century collection of wax teaching models. They're called moulages, and they show some of the lesions of leprosy. So here you can see what the faces of leprosy patients look like. And then these lesions on this person's leg are fairly typical. That's sort of the most common expression. On the skeleton, again, it affects the skin of the face and it gets into the nose and it begins to eat away the margins of the nose and causing inflammation in the nose and in the mouth. And so we see that these little tiny holes here and then here along the edge of the nose. It also destroys the bone that holds the front teeth. And so it's very common for people's front teeth to fall out if they have leprosy. And had this person lived a little bit longer, they probably would have lost their incisors here. And then it also just essentially flattens the nose. You get a collapse of the bony bridge of the nose and the face gets very flat. It also is found on the feet. And there are two things going on here, both the leprosy itself, but because it damages the nerves that give you any sense of pain or touch, people injure their feet and those injuries get infected. And so you get big ulcers like this on the bottom of the feet, and then the bacteria gets into the bones as well. What happens is the bones of the feet erode away. Here's a normal foot, and you see these two bones right here on the left are the same as these two bones here. And you can see how this is just narrowed to a point. Whoops, it's that bone is almost gone away. The toes here also are becoming sort of hourglass shaped, and that's typical. Here you see a more advanced version of that. This is one of the toe bones, and you can see it's just like lace in here. There's almost no bone left. Other times the whole ankle fuses together and even fuses onto the shin bone, the tibia here. And so this mass of bone here, which should have been a bunch of different bones, is fused together. The hands also are affected, either the skin. Sometimes the fingers shrink down until you have essentially just stubs. Other times when the nerves are damaged, as you can see over here, people get what's called a claw hand, where the fingers contract into a claw. On the bones, we see erosion like this. and damage to the finger bones. And here's a finger that is fused as well. So in looking at diseases, we try to figure out what's called a differential diagnosis, look at the different things that can cause some of these lesions. Syphilis, the venereal disease, can cause damage to the face and the leg, but it also causes lesions on the skull that we don't have. Diabetes and psoriatic arthritis also cause lesions, but not all of the things we're seeing here. But leprosy causes these four lesions, and the Thebes skeletons have them all. And so looking at the pattern of lesions, it suggests that what we have is leprosy. Again, we're having a DNA study done and hope to confirm this soon. But for right now, it's looking pretty clear just from the bones that this is leprosy. So one of the big questions with the cemetery is, why are there so many sick people? When we look at modern leprosy, but in the pre-antibiotic or time period, so before World War II, before there were effective antibiotics, in a population that has leprosy, you'd expect about 40 people out of every 1,000 to have it. There are more than 100 cases at Thebes, which would give us a prevalence of 547 per 1,000. Way beyond what you would expect across a big population. And the other diseases are also fairly common too. Now, brucellosis is not so common in the cemetery, but present. But the leukemias and cancers, when we look at the prevalence rate, are much higher than what we would expect in a normal population. So what we've got here is a concentration of sick people, probably coming in from a long way away. This is not just the village of Thebes producing this many sick people. We also have leprosy co-occurring with multiple diseases over and over again. So what we think's happening here is that we probably have a very early hospital. In the early Christian period, monasteries were taking in the poor and the sick and caring for them. And this is sort of the beginnings of the modern hospital. And we know in the 4th to 7th centuries in the Eastern Mediterranean, there was a great increase in disease and famine and lots of people who needed care. And so the early church stepped up and started taking these people in. And we see this in Western manuscripts, not in Greece, but these illustrations of lepers being cared for in monasteries. Are part of the evidence we have for this.
Maria froze. Everybody hang tight. Hopefully she'll come back. Got a lot of great questions here already. Obviously, I can't answer them. Actually, I can answer one of them because I studied microbiology. One of the questions from Jen is, why can't the bacterium that causes leprosy be grown in a lab? And that's a really great question because a lot of bacteria that grows all over the place, including in us, on our skin, in our gut, is just, we can't figure out what it needs to live. Because what humans and scientists can put in a tube to help them grow is just different from the environment that you might experience in your gut, in skin, in other places, even in the ocean, that we just can't figure out what they need. Now, in the last, I would say, 5 years, there have been new techniques to try to figure out and basically ask the bacterium what it needs so that we can give it that. And so the way that they've been doing that is by looking at the genome or the DNA of the bacterium and seeing what kind of tools they have to digest stuff. And so if for example, you know, someone eats exclusively potatoes, bananas, and chicken, the genome of this bacterium will have like the thing that digests chicken, the thing that digests bananas, and the thing that digests potatoes but they won't have the gene, for example, that maybe like your basic E. coli has that wants to consume only, I don't know, green beans. And so when you look to see what they have the tools to digest, you can figure out what they want to eat. And then hopefully over time, we can figure out how to grow them. And so there have been a lot of what we have historically called unculturable bacteria that we can now culture. I don't know if that's going to work out for leprosy, but maybe. Let's see how we're doing here. I hope we can get her back. Unfortunately, I don't know the answer to all these other questions, which is why we bring in experts. But I am also curious about one of these questions was also, I make a little list in addition to you all writing questions, because I also get super curious about this stuff. I want to know why it's just legs in a pile. I have no idea. That sounds cool. There we go. Maria's back. We're making her a panelist again right now. Maria, can you hear us?
Yes.
Wonderful. Okay. Don't worry. It happens to the best of us.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure what happened. I could keep hearing you was the funny thing.
Oh, great. Well, I hope you enjoyed my uncultural bacteria monologue.
I was on the last slide. So let's take questions.
Okay, great. So our first question is, let's just ask the one that I was just talking about. What do we have any idea why they're putting legs in one place and what the heck they did with the ribs and up?
Right. Again, in the modern Greek practice, people are exhumed. So, you know, a village that's been occupied for 1,000 years has a tiny little cemetery. Our North American idea of these acres and acres and acres of graves, Greece doesn't have enough land to do that, and especially not enough farmland. And so the bodies are buried, you have, you know, a funeral, they decay in the ground, you have essentially a second funeral in the modern world, where the family gathers again, and the bones are gathered up, and they're put in a box, and then put over in a building on the side of the cemetery, usually, an ossuary. So we suspect that was going on. In the medieval period, they're often just put into a common ossuary. All the bones are mixed up, so you lose your individual identity. But in the 20th century, you have a box with your name on it.
Right. Yeah.
So we think that's getting started now, which is really surprising. We had no idea this was happening so soon.
Wow, that's super cool. All right, so why exactly do some skeletons like stay until today and others just dissolve? Like what makes some skeletons just stick around?
Right. It's the conditions of the soil. So if the soil is acidic, it breaks down bone really quickly. If you've got conditions that are fairly consistent, so it's always dry or it's always wet, they'll preserve really well. Unfortunately, what's bad for bone and any organic material is to have hot and dry summers and cold and wet winters, which actually we have in Greece. And so when you get further back in time, skeletons don't preserve well. But these were pretty deeply buried, and so the conditions were, you know, stayed more stable. But yeah, it's soil and heat and water conditions will determine that.
Sounds good. Our next question is from James. Can studying ancient diseases help us understand modern diseases?
Yes, it can. And in fact, the DNA study that these bones are being part of is done at the Max Planck Institute, and they are studying plague and trying to understand the origins of bubonic plague, where it got started and how it's changed through time. But in doing that, they're testing bones from as wide, you know, as much of the world as they can to try to capture the DNA of plague and other diseases. So they're particularly interested in our mass graves because they want to understand how plague appeared, what, you know, how many changes it had from earlier forms when it came to Greece. And there's been very little work done in Greece on this. So this will be useful for filling in that blank on the map.
Right. Cool. The next question is, how do we cure leprosy today?
It's antibiotics, some specific antibiotics that were developed in the 1950s. It's a fairly long course. You have to take it for 6 months or so, but in fact, it can be cured. The damage can't be undone, unfortunately, but you can stop the bacteria.
Sounds good. Well, Fiona yes. and I were really worried about that one. Okay. The next question is, like, how do you get leprosy in the first place? Like, I know that I've been told that I'm not supposed to pet any armadillos, even though they're incredibly cute. I've seen one in the wild one time. I live up in Pennsylvania. We don't have them. But how do you get it?
Well, it, again, very topical. It seems to mostly spread through droplets. People get it in their nose and they get a lot of congestion and they sneeze.
Oh boy.
And they breathe it out and you pick up these. Now it is really in the droplets because it's the bacterium, which is a lot bigger than a virus. But the same way that COVID-19 is spread, leprosy is spread. It doesn't seem to spread through touching somebody who has leprosy.
Oh.
But if you touched that armadillo and then wiped your nose, that you might give it to yourself.
Okay. Good to know. Good to know.
Yes.
Great. So let's see. How many, if any, burials were there in that cemetery that you were looking at where there was no sign of disease on the body? Were there any?
There were no graves that had no disease. Every grave had multiple skeletons in it, and there were a few that didn't seem to have disease. But of course, most of the diseases that kill us don't show up on bones.
Right.
So it's amazing that there were as many as there are.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just a very unusual concentration of disease, which tells us this was not the village. You know, this wasn't everybody who was dying. It was people who were coming here because they were sick.
Do we think that at that time there were hospitals that specialized in, like, I don't know if they would have known at the time that it was diseases that affect your skeleton, but diseases that maybe, like, affect mobility or... Yeah.
It's probably more general. And when I got cut off, I was about to say that we think the reason this may have been here is right across the street in a church that is still active, but built on the foundations of an ancient temple, is the burial place of St. Luke the Evangelist, who's believed to have written the Gospel of St. Luke. St. Luke died in Thebes, and he was a physician, a doctor by training. And so, you know, because he wrote one of the four Christian Gospels, it's likely pilgrims would have come to his grave. But because he was a physician, it's likely that sick people would have come looking for healing.
Right.
And so we suspect, but there's no record of that. It's sort of a gap in the ancient or, you know, early Christian literature. But it's very plausible that pilgrims would have come there because St. Luke was buried there.
That makes sense. Sounds good. Fiona, age 9, would like to know, are there different types of leprosy?
There are, but it's not so much different types of bacterium, but it's different ways your immune system may respond. Mm-hmm. Some people have a very good immune response and so have a very light case of it and actually can even clear it. And those individuals most often just have the skin lesions. Other people have a very poor immune response, and this seems to be genetic. You know, it's not like they have AIDS or some other disease that's affecting their immune system. It's just their immune system doesn't respond well to leprosy, and so they tend to get the much more severe cases. Some people over a long course of the disease will go from the lighter type of case to the heavier case, and they've got different names, but yeah, it actually is how your immune system responds that makes the difference.
Cool. Sounds good. The next question is from Susan. How did you become interested in the study of leprosy?
Well, I had never seen it before, and was invited to come work on the skeletons from the graves in the cemetery. I knew the two directors. I didn't get to show you my slide with the acknowledgments, but Professor Kevin Daly and Professor Stephanie Larson at Bucknell University were the directors of this project, and they invited me to come work on the graves. And it was, you know, only in the first year of beginning to go through these bones, and it's like, what's going on here? I've never seen this before. And then that bone that was, you know, tapering almost to a little point, the student who was working with me held that up and said, what's this? And they could hardly drag me out of the lab that night. I was so excited. So that's how I got interested, was because I found it in these skeletons.
Super cool. Let's see. So Claire wants to know, is it common that a hospital would bury perhaps like ultra disease with a specific type of disease people in one place, and then like the more healthy dead people, like, you know, someone who maybe just got like a spear in the middle of them or something, elsewhere, or what?
It's likely that sort of everyone that was dying at this hospital or hospice is buried there. And again, there are some people who don't seem to be, certainly people who don't have leprosy. Right. Every grave has someone with leprosy, but not everyone has leprosy.
Gotcha.
And okay. Again, the cancer patients. And the, I mean, there's one person who had fractured their thigh bone, their femur, shortly before they died. And very often that killed you. That was a really serious injury. And that's the only thing wrong with him. And so he apparently had an accident, broke his leg, was brought there and died.
Right.
And so just was buried in the cemetery.
Cool. And Claire wants to know, a follow-up to that. So the staff, the ones working with the sick people, presumably would be buried somewhere else, or?
We don't know. And again, we've got the part of the cemetery that was on that hilltop, but it probably extends possibly all the way over to the church, which is, you know, across the street. Actually, it's diagonally across. There's an intersection. And so we don't know. There is a modern cemetery now around that church, and it's likely people were being buried there even, you know, for a very long time. But we just had the plot that it's actually a park where people walk their dogs all the time in Thebes. So that's what we had the permit to excavate.
Cool. So I have a potentially silly question. Often, you know, when we're trying to find older stuff, we dig down. But like, how does that happen? Like, how do we go from having a town that's above the dirt to being buried? Like, it doesn't, you find these like buildings that are all in one piece. Were they buried all in one fell swoop? Like, how does this happen?
Buildings die when they're abandoned or burned or something like that in a fairly patterned way. The roof tends to fall in, so you get a pile of stuff from the roof and a mix of wood and tiles or whatever they were roofing with, and then the walls fall in on top of that. And in the ancient world, in Greece at least, a lot of houses were actually built of what we call mud brick.
Uh-huh.
It's bricks, but they're not fired. And they build a stone foundation to keep that up off the ground, and then they build the mud brick house and put plaster on it. And as long as you keep a roof on it and keep renewing your plaster every year, mud brick is very durable. But when you stop doing that, then it starts falling in. And all the way into the 20th century, houses were still being built that way occasionally in Greece. Now they use cinder block and brick and things like that that are much more permanent. But so that mud brick, which essentially is just dirt, collapses in, and that's part of what buries things. Now, the cemetery never had much built on top of it. So the graves are only, you know, maybe about 18 inches below the ground surface. We hit the top of the grave cuttings, but then they're cut very deep. And again, we think there was some concern about the bodies perhaps, because I mean, when I was standing in one, I mean, sometimes I'd be standing on the bottom of a grave and it'd be up to my nose practically. Others are more shallow, but that isn't buried deeply. It was just below the modern topsoil. We start hitting the graves occasionally.
Cool. That's so strange and cool to be thinking, like, what are we walking over right now?
Right.
So cool. Colin would like to know, how accurate are the scenes from Monty Python and the Holy Grail? You don't have to know the answer to that.
The fabulous question, not very. Pieces do not fall off of your body when you have leprosy. Let's say they are accurately humorous, but perhaps not medically accurate.
Not medically accurate. Sounds good. Let's see. Are there other examples of leprosy cemeteries elsewhere in the ancient world?
Yes. There have been isolated cases found in Greece. Mm-hmm. In the medieval period, so get a little bit later, it becomes very common in Europe. Denmark, for example, had a terrible problem with leprosy for centuries. Cases have been found in England, in France, sort of all over Northern Europe. So it's there. The problem is that it's fairly rare to get the really extreme lesions, again, like that bone that was, you know, almost like a pencil point. And so otherwise it kind of looks like an infection. Mm-hmm. And so if you've only got one or two people, you may say, oh, well, you know, there was an infected wound, but you wouldn't necessarily go to leprosy until you start seeing a whole bunch of it.
Gotcha. Excuse me. The next question is from Meredith. Were they buried with any kind of grave goods associated with the burials? I know you mentioned there were those pots. Were they like part of the burial process?
Yes. In the Orthodox, well, what's now the Orthodox burial practice, and probably going back into the early Christian period, often they would pour wine or olive oil on the grave, and then apparently just leave the pot in the grave. So these are all little small pots. There were small numbers of other artifacts. There are a few belt buckles, there are a few earrings, there's a glass ring. But these were not wealthy people, and so there's not a lot there, but just a little bit, and a very few coins too, but not many.
Cool, that's super neat. Do you know anything, so this is from my experience working in Hawaii, because I study Hawaiian squid, and right off of Oahu, you can see this island called Molokai, and that's where a leprosy colony was. Do you know anything mm-hmm. about that place or what those people went through?
Well, in the starting in the late medieval period, but definitely up into the 19th and early first half of the 20th century, as better understandings of contagion and how you catch disease developed, lepers were isolated. Greece had a little island off of Crete called Spinalonga, which was the last leper colony in all of Europe, I think. And so it was a way to keep leprosy from spreading in the population. Once the antibiotics were developed and people were cured, they could leave, although in many cases they'd lived there for so long and were so disfigured that they wanted to stay with people who weren't horrified by the way they looked. And so many people went on and lived the rest of their lives on these islands. But an island was an easy way to separate the sick people from the well people.
Right. So to what extent were those colonies just towns that happened to have people affected by leprosy in it? Because you said leprosy can take like 30 years, right? So it's not, you can live with leprosy for quite a long time and mm-hmm. be pretty functional. So were they just like towns that happened to have people with leprosy living in them?
No, governments began to force people as soon as they had symptoms of leprosy to move into these areas, trying to keep it from spreading. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't voluntary, usually.
Sounds good. The next question is from Jen. Were the graves in your Greece site in Thebes marked, or did they have any tombstones at all?
Not by the time we got to them. Again, it's been 1500 years since some of those people were buried there. It was just a hilltop with pine trees on it, right. But it had the temple foundations were known. And so again, they weren't planning to dig a cemetery. They were planning to dig a sanctuary of Apollo. Right. It turns out that most of the remains of the sanctuary, the modern Thebans took the stones and built houses with them, and they're all over the town. there was the cemetery scattered all through it. And that's typical of archaeology. You know, what you think you're going to get and what you actually get.
Maybe totally.
If we knew what was under the ground, we wouldn't need to dig it.
Exactly. Cool. That's gotta be exciting. That's super
exciting. It is.
So you said that when you're trying to figure out how old a grave site is, you were checking the pots instead of the skeletons. Why would you do the pots instead of the skeletons?
Well, the sequences of ceramics are very well known.
Oh.
And we have a professor from the University of Virginia, Fotini Kondali, who's an expert in Byzantine pottery. And she has been working on them and can date, knowing how the pots change through time, can actually date a grave often more tightly than we could if we did radiocarbon dating. But that, you know, to do that, we have to destroy the bones.
Right.
To date the pots, Fotini can just look at them. I mean,
wow.
You know, it's
cool.
A very knowledgeable look. But so it's when you know the ceramic sequences, sometimes that's a more precise date.
That's so cool. That's awesome. Okay, so so we try to keep these sessions to be about 45 minutes, and so.
Okay.
We're approaching that time. So we always ask the same two questions of everybody at the end. The first question is, if you had the attention of everyone in the world and you can tell them one thing about your area of expertise, what would that be?
That skeletons are an important part of archaeology and that it's very exciting to get to see and understand the people. And as one of the first questions said, or asked about, this can inform us in the modern world with diseases. And so there's important information there, and it's exciting too.
Awesome. And then the second question is, you still have everybody's attention in the whole world, and you can tell them one thing about literally anything. It can be as big picture, important, or silly and insignificant as you'd like.
Well, in studying disease in the ancient world, it gives me real optimism in the condition of the world today. I mean, we're dealing with a pandemic. And human beings have survived pandemics before. We're very fortunate that we've got all the medical support and hopefully fairly soon a vaccine. I mean, I hope by the end of 2021, much of the world will have been vaccinated and we aren't dealing with this disease anymore. But we will get through this. But it's not something unique. You know, some people are acting like this has never happened. This is so terrible. It's like, this has happened to human beings over and over and over again. We've just been spoiled with vaccines and antibiotics that we haven't dealt with this recently. So, you know, it be patient and do what you can to control it. And we'll get through this one too.
Sounds good. Thank God for modern medicine.
It's absolutely.
A real blessing. All right. Well, thank you so much. Is there anything, where can we find you online? Is there anything else you'd like to plug? And then we'll wrap up.
Well, I'm at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, and if you Google the anthropology department at Waterloo, you'll find me. And, you know, support your local museums and archaeological sites, and volunteer and participate if you're interested too.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. I learned everything you said, basically, is something I learned. That was really, really cool. Thank you so much for taking the time. And Tammy, thank you for signing for us.
Yes,
we really appreciate your time and for being with us today. And everyone, thank you for coming. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about blogging archaeology at 1 p.m. Eastern. So please join us then for another Q&A all about archaeology. We will see you all then. Bye.
Bye.